Happening now, we'd like to welcome our viewers from across North America and around the world. This is the EdTech Situation Room, episode 313 for December 13th, 2023. My name is Wes Fryer, and I am not coming to you from Blowing Rock, North Carolina, which is what it looks like. Actually, I'm not able to use my fancy iPhone because XSplit VCam is still not updated, but virtual backgrounds can be done in multiple ways. I am excited to have my last day of work for the 2023 fall semester at Providence Day School tomorrow, where I'll be proctoring a final exam. And I am a middle school media literacy and STEM teacher there. And I'm joined by, as always, by Dr. Jason Neifer, who I think is in some kind of architectural demo room there in Missoula. What's your location tonight, Dr. Neifer? And what are you doing anyway?
Well, actually, I'm not sure what I do. I'll let you know when I find out. I don't know where I'm at here. So we'll talk about this a little bit later, but our recommendation for the best virtual background system is XSplit VCam, and it's been broken for a while, and there's a new beta version out of a rebranded one, but I'm using it tonight, and this was the first thing that popped up on the background wise, but I'll have to get all my custom ones done in there. But hey, I'm Jason Neifer. I'm the executive director of the Montana Digital Academy, which is Montana State Virtual School located on the beautiful University of Montana campus right here in Missoula, Montana. And Saturday here in Missoula, the UM Grizz football team is doing the national semifinal for the, and I can't remember the name, it used to be called Division II NCAA, and it's not, or 1AA, actually, it's now called something different, like National Championship Series, but Grizz had a overtime win last Friday night, and then we're excited to see our boys take on North Dakota State, actually, is who we'll be seeing in the semifinals. So very exciting times here in beautiful Missoula, Montana.
That is great. And are you getting some winter weather, and will you have a white Christmas?
We probably will have a white Christmas. We did get, actually, it dumped snow over the weekend. In fact, Monday morning when I went in, it was like actively dumping snow. Some of that is melted. We did have beautiful sun rays in Missoula today, which is just not usually the winter experience here. We get a lot of cloudy days in the Missoula Valley in the wintertime, which frankly is a little rough on the brain, as it turns out. But yeah, we're hoping for you know, I live in Montana, so snow is no big deal. I'd rather have snow and cold temperatures than just cold temperatures.
Awesome. Well, last week we had our annual gift giving guide and did not talk EdTech articles. And, you know, there are a few things every week now that seem to have these initials AI in them. So what are we going to do tonight, Jason? What have we been doing for 313 episodes, except for the holiday gift guide?
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. So, we're going to take a look at some news, and you may remember a couple weeks back, we talked about maybe breaking down our AI into subcategories since it was turning into 30 random links in there. And so tonight we will have some AI ethics and social impact news, some AI technology innovations news, some AI policy and regulation news, some tech correction, social media news, and then we'll also take a quick dance through Apple, Microsoft, Google news, and then, of course, our famous category, miscellaneous, and then we'll end the week on our Geeks of the Week. Dr. Fryer, where'd you like to start tonight, sir?
You know, let's go to social media, and I guess this probably goes there. I'd had it under miscellaneous, but this sort of tags along with what we were talking about with gift guides, and I had not heard of this before, so the article is from NPR today. It's called Parent and Consumer Groups Warn Against Naughty Tech Toys. But I had not heard of this before. This is a 15-page PDF, and I do recommend that you go ahead and click the link in the article to download. The summary of the article is that basically there are gifts that are technologically focused, powered, that can offer, you know, different kinds of dangers for kids. A lot of them have to do with privacy and the collection of information, but it's also the potential exposure of students to objectionable content, to predators. And as I said, I recommend that you go ahead and download the 15-page PDF. And I want to highlight just really quick a couple things. On page 6, there's a really good description of why Roblox, which I perceive for the middle schoolers that I teach, is now vastly more popular than Minecraft. Roblox is basically, as far as I understand it, a sandbox for other kinds of games. And so a whole lot of folks, including, you know, big teams that are making lots and lots of money, sometimes employing kids, and we've talked about some of those controversies before. Basically, there's just a whole lot of different things that kids play. And I think there can be some some great games there. But what they highlight under potential dangers is, quote, when our staff signed up for a Roblox account, we found that the default settings on that account were set to the least private option. Accounts for kids as young as 7 automatically permit strangers to engage in text chat with them, display content and experiences rated 13 plus, and have all parental approvals and controls deactivated. So it goes into talking about the chat feature and how that can be dangerous. There's games that involve concentration camps. Kids can play Nazis. They can go to strip clubs and earn Roblox bucks for giving lap dances. So the NPR article does not go into detail about what the issues are, but the PDF does. And so I definitely think, as I've talked before, I used to do parent university sessions when I was tech director. It's just really important to be aware of what, you know, kids, you know, are doing or what they can potentially do. The internet today in 2023 is not the internet of 1995 or 2015. I mean, it really has moved on in a lot of really good ways, but also in some potentially objectionable and even dangerous ways. So it goes on to talk about MetaQuest. There are a lot of concerns about hate speech, harassment, bullying. They talk about the settlements that some of these companies have had. Fortnite, you know, matching children and teenagers and strangers, bullying threats, harassment, the Ray-Ban, smart glasses from Meta are in here. But a couple to point out that I hadn't thought of before, Twitch Prime, you know, there's a lot of kids, and I've been aware of this because of just talking to kids about games that they play, you know, using Twitch. This points out there are no parental controls or other safety settings even possible in Twitch. So while Roblox has them, ironically, you know, because it's heavily marketed to kids, turned off and at the lowest setting, they are not available in Twitch. And so it goes into some of those details. And it even lists Kindle Unlimited because of the, you know, content that it's just a wide open, you know, wild west of content. And it says that there's no way for parents, I guess the charge for the subscription service doesn't show individual downloads, so parents can't see what, you know, kids might have downloaded. There are no parental controls in the Kindle Unlimited. And it also lists YouTube Premium and indicates how, you know, in fact, it talks overall about social media and some of the things we've talked about is how it's, you know, geared to addiction and that there's different kinds of harms that have been documented, you know, for youth. And like the third thing, YouTube is designed to be addictive and without appropriate guardrails, young users are especially vulnerable. So I think the detail that provides on some specific tools is outstanding. I had not heard of this group before. It's called Parents Together, parents-together.org is their website. And the article, you know, begins by quoting, the online safety campaign founder saying they don't think kids should be raised without access to tech, but they definitely think that parents should be more informed. And from what I've, you know, seen in this article and the PDF, it sounds like that is a balanced approach and would be an excellent thing to share with anyone in your life and certainly for yourself if you have young people in your life. It's a good thing to pass along. And I might even, you know, share that with my parents as we finish up the semester.
Yeah. That's a great idea. And it's funny you should mention Twitch. I saw this headline and ignored it, earlier, but now it means a lot more. Twitch announced today, which by the way, Twitch owned by Amazon, that they announced changes. This is according to Variety today, announced changes to its policies under which certain types of sexual content that were prohibited previously will now be allowed if appropriately labeled. Under the new rules, artistic depictions, meaning that they are drawn, animated, or sculpted, or fully exposed female presenting breasts and or genitals or buttocks, regardless of gender, which aren't words I anticipate using in the podcast tonight, are now okay. If creators label the content as containing sexual themes. And I mean, the bottom line is that, you know, it's hard enough already, I think, to regulate your child's internet use. There's much more tools now than there were, say, even 15 years ago. And I know we've talked a couple of them, and Wes, when you still had kids in the house, I remember you talking about it too in context of what you were doing with your family. But the bottom line is that we shouldn't be making that tougher, right? Because it's already pretty darn tough. And yeah, that's really interesting. And the Roblox thing is also very concerning too, because that's, I mean, I don't hear about a lot of Roblox being used by adults. I hear it being used more or less by kids. And so, yeah, I just feel like that's troubling for sure.
And it's written in a really nice infographic way, that PDF, very accessible. So, yeah, I think it's incumbent upon those of us that are, you know, plugged into the techosphere with different tools and things like that to be able to share those things out. And that sort of thing sounds like a really easy and important thing for us to be able to share with other, you know, parents in our lives and folks that are their grandparents and considering gift giving and things like that.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. What to next?
Well, let's do some other tech correction news. This is really exciting news, and it looks like we both had some version of this article, but The Verge reported today, as well as 9to5 Mac, that Threads is going to start utilizing a protocol called ActivePub, or ActivityPub, which is essentially an integration with Mastodon. And that's very exciting news. I'm now basically off of Twitter now. I open it up once or twice a week. I did delete it off my phone about a week or so ago. And part of it is because, with maybe one or two exceptions, most of the creators and educators I want to connect with are no longer on Twitter. I still am very disappointed in that, because the last thing I wanted to do was download a bunch of additional apps to be able to connect with my professional peeps. But, Threads so far has been a good experience for me, and I like it. It is a very good, platform. And I feel like that in general, the mojo there is pretty good, right? That it's got a nice positive thing. So being able to connect my Mastodon to that means that the nerdles that are on Mastodon, like Dr. Fryer and myself, will be able to connect with the non-nerdles on Threads a lot more easily. And I think that's a really, really good piece of news.
I won't completely preview my Geek of the Week, but it does tie to this. And, you know, ActivityPub is more than just Mastodon. And as we think about the ways in which a standards and protocol-based internet led to transformative connections, right? Because Dr. Neifer and I are young enough, old enough to remember the days of AOL and the days of CompuServe, and when you got a CD in the mail and you would put it in your modem and you would, you know, connect to this one world. You weren't interconnecting. Well, then these standards came about, where we could connect AOL to CompuServe and email to anyone, and it was just so magical. Well, standards are what did that. And so ActivityPub, as a lot of people have just thought of Mastodon as, oh, well, this is just my Twitter replacement, or could it be my Twitter replacement? And that is a valid question to ask and a way to use it. But ActivityPub is a lot more than that. And so I think it's positive, cautiously positive, that Meta is looking at those kinds of standards, because ultimately I think we as an internet community, and particularly as, you know, educators and just, you know, tech geeks and people who want to collaborate with others and partner, like not having just a proprietary way of doing that that's owned by, I don't know, someone named Musk or whoever, you know, I think that there's a lot of benefit to that. Now, as I might talk about in one of these other articles, there, you know, tools, secrecy, privacy, there's going to be all kinds of issues that are going to play in terms of how something can be used, you know, in good ways or, you know, arguably in bad ways or hurtful ways. But I think it's very positive. And it's, to me, super interesting as well, because you wouldn't think that Meta, a company that's focused on, you know, making money, would want to embrace necessarily this kind of an open standard. But I think it's really exciting. And it's still a confusing landscape, right? I mean, at least with Threads, you don't have to pick a server and navigate, you know, well, what server do I want? Who owns that server? You know, you just sign up with Threads. So I think it's positive as well. So I'm glad for you to highlight that. And I predict that in 2024, ActivityPub is something we will talk some more about. I think it's going to be a big thing.
Yep, absolutely. That's great to hear. And then related story on Threads. Threads is going to give you the ability to push fact-checked posts further down your feed. And I had to read this article twice to understand what the heck they were talking about. Because what I thought was that they were going to, well, basically that they were going to allow you to put posts that were fact-checked in a good way down your post too. But basically, if I'm reading the functionality correctly, by setting up the three levels, no pushing down, some pushing down, maximum pushing down, what it basically does is take controversial things and get them the heck out of your thread, right? And while, and the article does make comments about censorship and, you know, where it's the line with that and how do you determine that. That's all true, but and I think it's complicated, right? And we are, remember, trusting our friends at Meta, which don't have a lot of trust in the world right now. And certainly that's the case for me as well. But the bottom line is that I do think it's a really, it's good to have controls like this available to yourself, right? And I will say that with the occasional exception of a political something or another on Threads, it's pretty good positive stuff there, right? And so, the ability to push things down that are aggressively fact-checked, seems like a good feature to me.
From what I've read about Threads, where I think this is coming from is Zuckerberg originally was saying, this isn't going to be a news place. This is not going to be a Twitter. It's going to be a place to connect to friends and others and not a place to become, you know, a hotly contested arena of polarized discussion about politics and current events. So the way that I would interpret this is it's trying to give you as a user the ability to basically put, like you said, the controversial things, things that have had to be fact-checked, just not hide. It's interesting. They're not hidden, but they're just pushed down in your feed. So you're going to be less likely to run into those. And I'll say that the more controls and filters that we can have on our social media tools to decide whether we want our feed to be algorithmically, you know, sorted or not, whether we just want a chronological feed or, you know, how we want to do those things. In fact, ooh, I'm going to do another, I'll add another one to my Geeks of the Week. I overshare with my Geeks of the Week, so maybe I won't. Well, I'll just say it now. I'm using Mastodon clients. Mammoth has added some excellent curated lists, because I had stopped using that in favor of Ice Cubes. Ice Cubes has AI descriptions built in for images. So when you do an image, you say add description, click, and it creates a draft of a accessibility alt description. All of these features I think are wonderful, and we're going to just continue to see more of them built. So good for Threads, giving us these kinds of options, and you know, decide how you want to filter your feed. Do you want to keep that controversial new stuff, you know, more likely to be out? Switch that on. Interesting though that it lives in Instagram, right? So that shows you how it's very Instagram driven, but I think it's experimental. And I think that's positive. But it's really interesting to see all this evolution, because we really are in a formative time with this kind of open standards activity pub social media that to me is very reminiscent of the early days of Web 2.0 in, you know, the early and mid 2000s and that time. And I think it's exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you want to cover that Discord article, Dr. Ferrer?
Sure. So Discord is a powerful platform for chat. When Midjourney came out, and I guess this is still true, right? If you use Midjourney to, you know, generate, generative AI art, photographs, you know, images, you need to use Discord in order to do that. Well, this is a Washington Post article from yesterday on December 12th, and it's called "Problematic Pockets: How Discord Became a Home for Extremists." And so, I don't know if you remember this, but a few months ago, there was a really big security breach that happened, but it happened during COVID. And so there was this like National Guardsman who was basically inside Discord sharing classified secrets. And it led to the Pentagon saying, wait a minute, you know, why is this very low level airman having access to these kinds of classified materials? Well, what the article describes is that the way that Discord is, basically Discord hasn't been designed really well for maintaining documentation of things. And so when that stuff went down with these security threat, with these security breaches and the release of classified information, the Discord folks, because of the way the app was designed for privacy and confidentiality, like they weren't able to peer into what they were doing to really know it. And it also allowed that individual, okay, his name is Jax Teixeira, young Air National Guard member from Massachusetts who allegedly exploited Discord's lack of oversight and content moderation to share top secret intelligence documents for more than a year. It allowed him to, and others, I guess, whoever, people involved, to delete a lot of that stuff. And a lot of the evidence was gone and Discord couldn't, you know, come up with it. And so I think we're seeing that with Telegram and what's the other one besides Telegram that's a private messaging app that a lot of people are using. But the debate is like, which one is more secure? Signal and Telegram.
Yep.
I have them both. They're not downloaded right now because I haven't used them in a long time. But, you know, these are apps that are fully encrypted and they're being used, you know, in some cases, you know, dissidents, folks in Ukraine, in different places, journalists and others are being able to communicate securely and not have, you know, a government that would be hostile to what they're trying to share with the wider world, being able to see their messages. Well, it also allows, you know, extremist groups, white supremacist groups, terrorist groups, other folks to be able to use those sorts of things. And so it kind of goes into detail about that, describes how it started with, you know, gaming and gamers. And again, this quote, P.S. Barge, a media scholar and PhD candidate at the University of Central Florida, says, quote, Discord was known for a while as the Nazi platform. This is a quote. It was preferred by white supremacists because it allowed them to cultivate exclusive, protected, insulated private communities where they could gather and share resources and misinformation. And so Discord was used to organize the Unite the Right event in Charlottesville, Virginia. And you know, supposedly the company has made some changes, but also back to the first article I shared, as a parent or grandparent or, you know, a teacher, I don't think that we should be letting, you know, elementary and maybe even middle school kids just loose without any kind of interaction or oversight on different platforms, to include Discord. And I think that this points to, you know, some questions about, you're always going to have tension because of privacy, because of security and privacy, right? If you have encryption, then by just definition, it's going to be more difficult, or maybe it's going to be impossible, even though they've got robust capabilities, for law enforcement, the NSA, you know, different kinds of groups to be able to read your mail, so to speak. And so that's going to be an ongoing issue that we have. And I thought this was a great article that was a deep dive into these different issues and thinking about how we could even regulate around this, I think is very challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've said this several times, but I think it's worth repeating here because it's the crux of the debate, right? Like, in the same way that, you know, Dr. Fryer and I were both delighted 25 years ago when the internet provided this extraordinary power for people to publish, that comes at a risk and it comes at a cost, because the bottom line is that while we, you know, love that, you know, it's not like it's limited just for good. In the same way that universal communication and the ability to connect with anyone, anytime, anywhere in a relatively private space is amazing, but comes with risks. And that, if you want a crux to where I think it's a little problematic, you know, the speed of the artificial intelligence technologies, it's going to push these discussions even more aggressively than they have been as of late. And yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And while it's troubling, I hope that we find interesting and good ways to figure these things out, so we can give kids the tools they need to do interesting stuff, but not, you know, put them at greater risk.
Yeah. I need to plug this a little bit more, and I need to actually send send this out, but in January, I'm going to be teaching a 6-week online course, which has been called Teaching the Conspiracies. I had a preliminary title for it, which was Sifting for Media Literacy Amidst Conspiracies and Culture Wars. So if you're interested in that, I'll include a link in the podcast show notes, which, by the way, I got 10 more of our old podcasts published. I've got about 21 still to go. So I am hopeful that by the new year, we will be all caught up. And if you haven't heard, I hadn't configured our backups properly, so we did not lose any data, but we're having to rebuild some posts. But all of those notes, in fact, I'll put the link into the show notes. All of them are on edtechsr.com/links. Speaking of which, where would you like to go next?
Well, let's do some, just some good old fashioned tech news. Let's maybe start at Microsoft. Two quick things, that interesting the last couple of weeks from Microsoft. The first one is that, PowerPoint for the web can now add videos with closed captions. And I've always thought that PowerPoint didn't get the respect that it deserved, in part because, people associate PowerPoint, the platform, with bad PowerPoints, and that's a good thing, but I think that's more user than it is platform. But I've seen people do amazing things with PowerPoint, both as a presentation software, but also as a learning platform. And I will say, even though it's not my primary platform for presentations, it's come a long way. And in the last 3 years, I feel like that the educational tools layered into it are pretty amazing stuff. But now you can upload videos to your on the web PowerPoint and add closed captions to them. And I do think that of all the major players, Microsoft seems to have the most consistent commitment for accessibility. And this is yet another piece of evidence of that. And, it's not easy to do this. Although if you've ever worked with captioning at all, it's not easy on any of the platforms, including YouTube for that matter. Unless you're doing just automated captions, which are real hit or miss, but I think it's a great new feature. And if you haven't checked out PowerPoint lately, that's either the newest desktop version or the web version. It is a pretty solid platform, and not your father's PowerPoint for sure.
Sounds good. Are you still using Microsoft 365 Office 365 to get transcriptions of audio? And is that still Yes. The best way to use AI to do that, in your opinion?
Yes. If you and they keep saying that it's free for now. So my work account, so that's a university school-based account, it's limited to like 100 minutes a month. But on the private Office 365 account I have, so it's just my personal Office 365 license, the web-based version still says it's unlimited. So I use that pretty frequently, and in fact got rid of my Otter AI account, which I was using quite a bit, although it's limited in the number of hours too for right now, because the web-based Word will do that for you.
I'll share this as a related aside. It's not a geek of the week, but I've been creating my own GPTs with ChatGPT-4, and experimented with creating one that would grade my student's final project in our web design class. And I had some luck with that. I ended up, it wouldn't read it as a link, but I could download, I tried to download as a PDF or print the page as a PDF. But what ended up the best was saving the source code to their web page. But the thing is, I ran into difficulty with how many queries that I had, because I had, 19 of these, I think, to grade. And so, it was again given, and it was using my rubric, and making a few mistakes, but then it was giving a reasonable narrative feedback in three different categories that I had asked for. But I ran into the issue of, you can't query us again for 30 minutes or something like that. And so anyway, interesting to experiment with that, but didn't end up saving me a lot of time. But it's interesting to be exploring with those, and I'm interested with that audio transcription. I don't have a Office 365 account currently, but if you end up running into other tools like that, was Otter comparable to it?
Otter's pretty good. And we are also experimenting with, most of our meetings are virtual in my day job, and we've been interested in utilizing an AI note taker, which in a lot of them now will even create to-do lists based on the meeting, and something we're playing with a little bit more. But yeah, AutoWork's pretty accurate. And it's funny, Dr. Fryer, because we've been working on custom GPTs the last couple of weeks too. We're going to roll out our third version next week of the Curricular-O-Matic, which is it's a bot we've created with now 60 pages of training data on best practices for developing curriculum, both student facing and standards association and stuff. And we've been doing some really cool and kind of wild things with it. So we've been very excited with the stuff there.
That's awesome. Hey, did you all have your AI playdate meetup that you were talking about?
We couldn't find a date that worked for the people that wanted to be involved, but I think we're going to try to do two of them this spring. And also, the University of Montana is going to have an AI conversation day. I want to say it's the 16th of January, but they're always speaking that day with kind of my standard standard speech on, you know, thoughtfully adapting education to AI in AI era. But I'm hoping that we can use that to springboard some interest in having this play dates in the spring.
If you would be interested, maybe we could pick an hour just sometime over the holidays to do one and just invite other people. Because I think that could be really, really fun. And I was thinking, because I haven't heard back on this, but I was hoping to do one here locally in February. And, you know, the idea of just kind of SmackDown style, like here's a Google form, you know, fill out something you'd like to share. And then you can just have people, you know, come, you know, grab the mic and share something cool that they've built or done. That was kind of the thought that I had, that would be fun to do online. Yeah, totally. And invite. So maybe you and I afterwards can look at our calendars and see if there might be an hour we carve out, and then we can invite anybody who wants to come. I bet between the two of us, we probably could just do a few demos ourselves, but it'd be really fun to have some other people that have been playing and doing different things. Cause even some of the stuff that's not even like academic and professional, but has to do with, you know, food and cooking. Did I tell you about our Thanksgiving dinner, what I did with that? Did you hear? No. Did you see Amber Tiemann? Yeah. So I just told ChatGPT, here's all the things I need to cook. Here's the temperatures. Here's the times. Give me a schedule. And it built a complete schedule of when I needed to put the turkey on, because I, with one oven, you know, when I needed to cook this, the dressing, everything. I followed the whole deal. It was awesome. We were supposed to eat at 6:00. We ended up at 6:30. So, you know, I pushed back a little bit. But still, that was just so cool to, you know, have a draft of here's a cooking schedule for the Thanksgiving meal, customized to each of the recipes that I need to prepare.
Awesome. That's great.
Okay, you want to do another some more Microsoft stuff to finish that?
Yeah,
round?
Just one quick thing here. So Windows 10 is end of life in 2025, and we haven't talked a lot about Microsoft lately because of the AI stuff. But I will say I now have a Windows 11 machine at home that I play with a little bit to keep up on the operating system, and it's fine. I mean, I like the interface in Windows 10 more, because 11 feels a little too, I don't know, polished for me. I like the more simple Windows 10 interface. But one of the things that we've talked about previously in the podcast is that Windows 11 requires an installed security chip framework on a machine to be able to upgrade to it. And I was concerned at the time, when we talked through this a couple of times on the podcast, that it was going to create an enormous amount of e-waste to put schools in kind of a rough position. So Microsoft has announced that you can buy up to 3 years of extended security updates for Windows 10, which take you to 2028. And that's all well and good. I don't love it that they're charging money for it, and I wasn't able to find anything in any of the articles that talk about how much money they would charge for that service. A lot of schools do have extended Microsoft contracts that, my guess, it would either give it to you very cheaply or as part of your larger contract. But the other article, and these are both from Throt.com, Paul Throt's website, that it's also available for consumers as well. No word on pricing yet,
But if you're someone that has a, you know, decently functioning Windows 10 laptop, and you don't want to upgrade to 11 and you still want to get security upgrades, which I would recommend that you do, don't use an operating system that isn't getting security upgrades. That's a way to do that. I hope it's inexpensive, so they don't force people onto Windows 11, especially since it's going to mean buying a new computer for some folks for sure. But I did think that was an interesting development for Microsoft.
I have a related Windows question. So, you know, Apple kind of forever, I think, has just said, here's your operating system. I mean, not forever. You used to buy, oh, it's now OS 9, it's OS blah, blah, blah. They used to sell, you know, boxed CDs that you would yeah. download and install to update your Mac. But at some point, they just decided, hey, we're going to give it to you. If your hardware supports it, you can install it. I kind of was under the impression that Microsoft had moved in that direction as well. Is that true, or it's a hybrid mix, or how would you describe Microsoft's, you know, upgrade your Windows box strategy at this point?
Well, I mean, if you have a Windows 10 machine, it will continue to update the Windows 10 versions, because there's two releases a year of Windows 10 up until the time at which it thinks that it's no longer going to do any good, right? Or that it can't support the features. And so, like, for example, Windows 10 in 2015 was released, was actually supported by a shocking number of older machines. Like, it, and it felt faster to me on older machines than Windows 7 did. But the bottom line, though, is that if you're going to upgrade to 11, then there was a free upgrade pathway from Windows 10 to 11 that didn't work for everyone, but worked for most people. But also, there are dirt cheap Windows license, like legit Windows licenses you can buy online for $20-$25. So even if you're building from scratch, which I don't even know anyone that does that anymore, you know, you could buy a Windows 11 license pretty cheaply. So it's certainly not the Mac atmosphere of, you know, that you own a Mac, here's your operating system, you know, it's part of the deal. But it's definitely for sure that it's a lot cheaper than it used to be to purchase Windows if you don't have it already.
Let's do this Google article. Maybe we want to do an Apple one. We'll just, you know, hit them all, and then we need to do some AI stuff. This is a Gizmodo article from yesterday on December 12th, and this is a pretty big deal. We've talked about Epic and Google and Apple and all these battles. Well, the headline from Gizmodo is, Google's App Store is an illegal monopoly, says jury in an Epic trial. And so this is a San Francisco jury that found the Google Play Store to be anti-competitive. They have ruled in favor of Google. To remind everybody, Epic, which makes Fortnite and other apps, has been in a big lawsuit with Apple as well. And what they wanted to do was, you know, charge people without paying the toll, the 30% or whatever that Apple, you know, takes. And I guess there's some negotiation that they do with other folks. But Apple won their lawsuit, but in this case, Google has lost. And so the judge, I guess, is going to be deciding what the repercussions are. The U.S. District Judge James Donato, presiding over the case, will decide in mid-January what the outcome will be. I'm just reading from the article. Epic Games didn't sue for monetary damages, but would like Judge Donato to rule that game developers can create their own app stores and have total freedom to use their own billing system. Judge Donato, Google, and Epic will reconvene in January to decide how this impacts the Google Play ecosystem, according to the Wall Street Journal. And there's several different articles that are quoted here. But this is a pretty big deal because we've been talking about this. And, you know, I think there's validity to the fact that Apple, as well as Google, have built these ecosystems. And as I think one of the Google representatives, and of course, I drink the Google Kool-Aid, right? So I'm going to probably show my favoritism for them. You know, when you compare this to a platform like, let's say, Xbox or PlayStation or any other kind of platform in terms of the openness, I mean, there's a lot of openness to the platforms that Apple and Google have built. But anyway, this is interesting, and it will be instructive to see where this goes and if this has implications for Google and other arenas, if it has, you know, implications for Apple as well. But this is an ongoing war that's been going on for quite a while. And I'm sure this is not going to be the last salvo of the of the engagement.
No, it's really not. And then the Apple news I'll share, this is from Vox on November 29th, and I saw an earlier version of, actually I heard an earlier version of the story, but I think it's pretty funny. Their headline is, "Local police should not be your go-to source for iPhone safety news." And in essence, what this is there's a new iOS 17 feature called Name Drop. In fact, I used it at a conference in November where you could just go up to someone else's phone and put the NFC tags close to each other and share contact information. And a police department, and I can't remember where it was located at, but a police department had warned local residents. Watertown Police Department in Connecticut warned that anyone can place their phone next to yours or your child's and automatically receive their contact information to include their picture, phone number, email address, and more, so long as the phone was unlocked. And of course it spread like fire on Facebook, and of course that is false. And that's not the way the feature works. It's very locked down. You know, Apple screws up occasionally, but there's no way that feature gets rolled out by Apple without massive international stories about it, right? So you would hear about this. But I do think that it's both funny and perhaps a little terrifying that the misinformation like that, or disinformation, or however you want to put it, false information like that can be spread so aggressively.
Yeah, and that article goes into how in the past two decades, with social media particularly, social media has supercharged the role local law enforcement and other government agencies can play in amplifying unverified stories, dubious rumors, allowing warnings to spread quicker and farther than a photocopied flyer. So yeah, just be careful out there, kids, because there's, again, SIFT, media literacy, especially when you find yourself, you know, getting upset or your emotions are being activated. It's time to stop, investigate the source, find trusted coverage, and trace to the original. So that would be kind of a case study in why it's important to do that. Or
yeah, situations here. For that.
All right. How about some AI news?
Sure. So many things going on in the AI world. Here's where I would like to start. There have been a lot of updates in the last couple of weeks. We didn't get a chance to talk about this yet. So let's start on new releases. First of all, Google has announced and somewhat released their Gemini model, which is the model that now backs Bard, and they will have advanced version of it available soon. And if you've seen the announcement video, there's been some controversy because Google apparently, I don't know, juiced the video a little bit, took some editing liberties. That's the BBC on December 8th reporting that. And there has been a lot of controversy about that, but it seems like that there is a lot of interesting new features available in the near future. But I wanted to share a couple of things. The first one is that I found out today, and I've started playing with it, that Gemini is available directly from Google now for free via their Google AI Studio. And so that's today's 9 to 5 Google.
And that's not Bard then? That's a direct Gemini? It's
direct Gemini, yeah. So you go to makersuite.google.com and you get access to their AI. And it's a little more informal looking than Bard, right? And it looks a little more like a development platform. And it's just it's just text generation. It can also upload images to analyze, but just text generation. So it's pretty cool. From what I've been able to see, you can play with all sorts of different factors that are more techie, you know, the output length and the what's called the temperature. So how kind of diverse or off the mainstream path the answers get. But so far, pretty great. And I played with it for 20 minutes this afternoon after work, and it looks pretty good. So if you want to play with that, you're an early adopter, that is now available. And then we should see also another announcement from Google is they have a new image generation model called Imagen 2. It is not available live yet, but it is available to developers to insert into their apps. And by a lot of people's accounts, you know, there's some debate whether these are better than DALL-E 3 and ChatGPT 4, but they seem at least better than DALL-E 2 and ChatGPT 3.5. So Google doing some catch up work here, and it seems like Gemini is pretty interesting stuff.
Can I just ask you a analysis question? Where do you see this going in terms of, let's say, your specific school scenario? How is this going to be changing virtual education curriculum? I mean, big ways, small ways?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, Dr. Fryer. What I've been thinking about lately is, you know, everyone, well, we've talked about this a couple of different times. My go-to line right now is we have to avoid easy answers to this, because easy answers are both incomplete and give us a false sense of security, right?
But everyone wants that, right? Everyone wants that. Oh, okay. Right. I don't have to worry. Oh, it's just fill in the blank.
Yeah. So, for example, you know, the articles about, all the debate about AI checkers, right? And to be honest, and we license one at work, in order to give our teachers at least a tool, but we also tell them that it is completely foolish to think that you're going to be able to detect your way out of it, right? And this, the other easy answers, filters, blocking at school. Like, you know, you may have a good reason to do that. The data privacy stuff itself is I think of certainly a real concern, but it's not a permanent answer to this question, because kids will be carrying around AI bots in their pocket. I know that a lot of schools are starting to push back against regular cell phone use in classrooms. I don't necessarily disagree with that. I think there's some instructional authority the teachers need to have with devices in the classroom, for sure, right? But what I would also say is that our students will have access to these technologies whether we let them have access or not. So we should be assuming that they have it whenever they're not in our purview. And so I keep thinking about this as macro changes that we need to make in education. So two of them that I think are a good example of this. The first one is, even though there's all the evidence in the world that it's a legitimate strategy for checking understanding and knowledge, objective testing on a computer is not going to work anymore in a world of AI bots. And so we've talked about college tools in the past. You know, obviously, if you're managing computers, you can prevent certain plugins from being installed. But, you know, that's an example. The second shift that I think we need to make is that, and there's some research released on this last week, but we need to be almost selling learning to our kids consistently and constantly, which is that we need to explain to students everything we do is for a reason, right? That we are learning about this because of this. And I think it's a mistake to say it's just relevance, because the bottom line is that a lot of learning that is, I think, important doesn't have immediate relevance to a student, right? It's a bigger picture piece. You know, or even like critical thinking, right? We're trying to develop your brain so that your brain becomes a stronger counterpart. But I think we have to layer that into all instruction now in order to help students understand that taking the shortcut with AI, I'm talking about using the tool in a meaningful or productive way. I'm talking about shortcutting with AI, has a lot to do with that. And then the third shift that I'm only starting to wrap my brain around, holy dog, media literacy has gone from being a good thing to do to absolutely necessary at all levels of education and all subject areas. And those are where I think the three big shifts are right now.
That's not just the influence of hanging out with me every Wednesday.
No, although, you know, you certainly, keep my attention on that, right? And as a former social studies teacher, that's part of it too for me, right? Like, I've always thought media literacy is super critical, but it's about to get a lot worse. And, a really easy answer to this, which is not so easy actually, is just to say we have to check everything on Google. But if you're looking at the first five links in Google, or worse, using their generative AI results, that's not what we're talking about. Like, you have to verify with authority. And the bottom line is that I think that's the stuff we need to be prioritizing now.
Maybe you should write a short book on transformative assessment or effective assessment in the age of AI.
Yeah.
You know, something like that. Because that's what part of what I'm hearing you say is we're just going to have to have different assessments. We can't objective, you know, use the same kind of multiple choice tests we've been using for a long time, and even essays. So
yeah, totally. Yep. That's exactly where I'm at, actually.
Okay. What else we got? You've covered 1/10 of the articles.
Yeah. On AI. Let's do a couple more quick AI ones. First, just because it's a follow-up to a past article, Mashable had a funny review of Grok, which is, X's generative AI model. And I have to tell you, I cannot begin to describe how little interest I have in using Grok, right? Like, and it's just, and part of it is because I have other platforms that are performing pretty well. I am oversubscribed right now in AI. And in fact, part of what I'll be doing, in late December is scaling back my AI platforms, down to just a handful because, it's gotten a little ridiculous. So, but that's all well and good, but I'm not going to pay $16 for access to it. I also really don't want a model that I have to access through Twitter. I think that's silly and not a kind of a waste of my time. But Mashable reports that, well, they call it a crypto loving insult comic, which is also woke, as it turns out. So remember, Elon Musk advertised Grok as, you know, the balm against woke, right? This is the way to deal with woke AI. But as it turns out, it's apparently pretty quote unquote woke as well.
If you get your website back up and running, I think an awesome page for you to maintain just briefly would be, these are the AI tools I'm subscribing to.
Yeah.
These are the ones I have before and I've retired. You know, it's just the dynamic speed at which that changes.
Oh, yeah.
Crazy. Let me do this AI under our AI policy and regulation category. This is Wired on December 8th. The EU just passed sweeping new rules to regulate AI. And this particular Wired article does not require a login. We've talked before. Oh, yeah. There's Betsy. She says, please let us know what you decide to keep. So, in fact, yeah, we could almost do an AI show, like an AI tool show in terms
yeah,
of
absolutely
the ones that we've used. Okay, so the European Union has agreed on terms for what they're calling the AI Act, a major new set of rules that will govern the building and use of AI and have major implications for Google, OpenAI, and others racing to develop AI systems. Months of debate. This is from the three branches of government, Parliament, Council, and Commission. They spent more than 36 hours hashing through the legislation. They were trying to strike a deal before the election campaign starts in the new year. And so the European Commissioner Ursula von der Leyen said on X, the EU Act is a global first. It is a unique legal framework for the development of AI you can trust and for the safety and fundamental rights of people and businesses. The article goes on to point out this isn't a world first. China has rules for generative AI that went into effect in August, but it is, quote, the most sweeping rule book of its kind for the technology. It includes bans on biometric systems that identify people using sensitive characteristics, indiscriminate scraping of faces from the internet. But this was also controversial, and part of the reason they were hashing so much, so much of the hashing was over this. Lawmakers agreed that law enforcement should be able to use biometric identification systems in public places for certain crimes. So just like we saw GDPR lead the world, I think, in terms of privacy regulation, we see the EU acting to have some regulation on AI. We talked on the show maybe a month ago or so about President Biden's executive order, which seemed to say some of the right words, but perhaps not do a lot of substantive things. it'll be interesting to see if this EU regulation, you know, ends up having a bigger impact. And I think it probably will because of the teeth that it has in terms of fines that it can impose. And so let's see if I've got this. Companies that don't comply with the rules can be fined up to 7% of their global turnover. The bans on prohibited AI will take effect in 6 months, the transparency requirements in 12 months, and the full set of rules in about 2 years. So this is regulations that have been passed, but they're going to take a while to roll out.
And I shared a link that goes to a LinkedIn page where a gentleman by the name of Oliver Patel created a really great infographic about what the AI law does. And I really like where we're starting with this because it doesn't try to paint a broad stroke about AI. And instead, it does a good job of there's four categories. The riskiest is prohibited AI, the next riskiest is high risk AI, the next risk is limited risk AI, and then there's minimal AI. So example of prohibitive AI that's prohibited, no social credit scoring systems. We've talked about those in the past as it relates to China. Emotional recognition systems that work in an education, completely prohibited. That using AI to exploit people's vulnerabilities, whether it's age or disabilities, untargeted scraping of facial images for facial recognition, you know, banned, prohibited. High risk examples include, education and vocational training, vehicles, medical devices, critical infrastructure, biometric identification, administration of justice, and then general purpose AI or minimal risk AI, as some people are calling it, is different in that there must be transparency for it. They must anytime you are have a high impact or create or introducing systemic risk, then you have to submit yourself to more broad transparency rules. And so, yeah, I think it's a really great start. This is where I'm going to say it's really good news for how this stuff tends to cross the pond, because as it turns out, EU ends up impacting more than the EU, because oftentimes companies will go to these regulations as a worldwide phenomenon, in the same way that California drives a lot of United States regulation, because they're a large enough area of consumers that a lot of times California-based regulations become national regulations due to the marketplace. So yeah, I thought that was a really great news and certainly a good step in the right direction.
Wow. And also I'll point out that you got that infographic from LinkedIn, which amidst confusion over Mastodon, Fediverse, all this stuff. Yeah. LinkedIn is a place where I'm seeing Dr. Neifer's ideas more frequently every week, because
I really like LinkedIn. Actually, I like having a place to just discuss professional stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we've got time maybe for one more article, and then we probably should geek of the week it.
Okay. Well, let's see here.
We didn't do any of the ethics and social impact. Do you want to grab one of those?
Actually, those go together. So okay,
we'll save those for next time.
Hunt those to next week. Actually, let's just do a quick fun one. This is, well, Sam Altman did talk to Time, and there's a video on that. I did watch the video today. Shout out to Martin Horagy, my doctoral advisor at UM, sent me a link to that. And he does talk about education, but the New York Times also released an interesting article that's related to what Sam Altman said at Time, although it was separate events. And basically, the article says that, and it's the reason why I think things are so complicated here, that the AI subculture, and this is from Kevin Ruse, the great reporter that's also the co-host of Hard Fork from the New York Times. But it's basically, we've talked about this a couple of times, but there is no breaking or slowing down of AI development, that the entire industry, as the headline says, AI subculture's model is go, go, go. The eccentric pro-tech movement known as effective accelerationism wants to unshackle powerful AI and then, as he says, party along the way. And he talks a little bit about what the potential risks of there are, but I see this in context of education, that, you know, we can't wait around for someone to come save us from this, because the technology is moving too fast. So the classroom teacher is as, or maybe even more important than the theorist and the researcher here in experimenting with, you know, different ways of going about this and sharing what's working and what's not. Like it's a real opportunity, I think, for the vastness of teachers working together and teacher conversation to help us along.
Okay. Geeks of the Week. We're at the top of the hour. Thanks, Betsy, for joining us. She was asking if, yeah, we saw the New York Times article.
Yes.
That said cheating has not increased since generative AI is released. I haven't seen that.
We'll cover that in greater detail next week. It's from a Stanford study that was released at the end of October. I did dig a little bit into it. And my initial reaction is that it basically says that student self-reporting on confidential surveys, which there's some debate about the effectiveness of those. But I tend to believe that students given an opportunity will tell you the truth, that it hasn't increased. My initial view of that is that that's interesting, but I also still think it's very early days with these technologies. And, when I have worked directly with students on the AI issue, most of them spoke of the fact that, they were scared of being accused of using AI. That's where they're at with it right now. So.
Okay. All right. Well, Geeks of the Week, I got a quick podcast. It's the Dot Social podcast by Mike McHugh. Mike is one of the co-founders of Flipboard, which will be a familiar, wonderful website or app and tool to Jason and many others that have been around for a while. The name of the episode is Activity Pub and the End of Walled Gardens with Evan Prodromo. And so anyway, this is where some of my excitement about the Fediverse comes and some of my education, because their point is that ActivityPub really is generating the kind of excitement and powerful collaboration that's standards-based that we saw in the mid-2000s with Web 2.0, but not even that, just with the internet. I mean, when the internet came out and, we could connect – you know, a world of AOL and CompuServe and, you know, global email and all that kind of stuff. So fantastic podcast series. I've only listened, I think maybe he came out with a third one. I haven't listened to that, but I've listened to the first two. And I put that right up there with Hard Fork as an outstanding podcast, kind of keeping the pulse of where social media is going and a lot of Activity Pub and just the social media landscape with Mastodon and Threads and the Fediverse and other things too.
That's excellent. And I'm now subscribed. Thank you, sir. And then I want to share an article that I've not tried out myself, and I need to figure out if I've got the hardware to do it. I think I do, but and I'm not even going to make an attempt to pronounce this gentleman's name, but he's a creator on LinkedIn. He's a senior cloud infrastructure architect at Amazon Web Services, and he has created a method to run a local LLM on an iPad or an iPhone, which in other words, you know, we've talked about a couple weeks ago, the whole notion of I use a piece of software that is called LM Studio to run local language models, open source local language models. But this is running it essentially on your iPad, iPad or iPhone. You have to have a decently hardcore recent iPad or iPhone to do it. So I'm going to play around with this a little bit. And there is one particular model that's called Mistral that apparently is somewhat better than ChatGPT 3.5, but not as good as ChatGPT 4.0 that you can run on your local machine now. So again, need some hardy hardware to pull that off. But it continues to be an interesting phenomenon.
Awesome. Well, we want to thank everybody for tuning in. We want to thank Betsy for joining us live. We want to invite you to join us live. We are usually here on Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, and wherever else you are in between. You can find all of our links at edtechsr.com/links, and those include ways to get in contact with Dr. Neifer and I. And any closing thoughts? We should ask ChatGPT to give us, you know, a closing over and out.
Yeah. No, other than where can people find me on the internet? Did you say that?
That's right. See, I knew something was missing. You can find all my links at westfriar.com/after. How about you?
You can find me, just search for Neifer on the internet. That's good enough.
That's right. There are benefits to having unusual names and not being called, you know, Joe Smith. So, all right. Well, until next time, we encourage everybody to stay savvy, stay safe, reach out to us, let us know you're listening. If you got any suggestions for shows, we will be posting on Mastodon and Facebook and some other places, you know, what we'll be doing for the holidays. It's entirely possible we may have a week off, but, you know, sometimes it's fun to keep things rolling, and we'll just have to see what everybody's schedules are. So until next time, we will see you on another episode of the EdTech Situation Room.
Good night. Good night.